right, I'll start over again. The meeting is called to order. There are senators who are in the Finance Committee and they're voting, so they may be coming and going. The House is glad that the Senate was late because we've been late the first two times, and I figure at 1:45 we're now at parity in late, so that's we don't like to be indebted to the Senate too much. I'm going to lay out what the plans are for today. And it could be that they change if we go longer than we think, and obviously we're starting later. But it's my intention anyway at this moment to not take a break for lunch. We're just going to plow through and hope to finish by mid-afternoon or earlier. Like I said, if I get really hungry, we might change that plan. But right now, that's the plan. And then we're going to hear from, first of all, Sue Abderholden, who's going to talk about the seclusion and restraint provision that's been worked on by many groups, and she's from NAMI, Minnesota. That's a provision in the House bill, that's not in the Senate bill, and apparently there wasn't, when we went through the side-by-side discussion of that issue, so we'd like to have everybody understand it. Then we'll go through the same that we didn't complete last night with the more popping up with staff combing through and see what we can agree upon. We'll do the same with the similars. And then we would like to discuss, the House would like to discuss anyway, having key legislators for some of the key issues that can kind of talk about those things and become more informed and talk with people in the room and other legislators who may have worked on those issues but aren't on this conference committee. And then when we discuss those key issues, we'll have some common understanding, and we will be discussing them publicly. Then we'll open it up for testimony. I had at least two people that asked that are here in this room that would like to have a chance to just address the conference committee about specific issues before we have those discussions at the table when we might not have as much time for testimony as we do today. So that's kind of the game plan, and I'd like to start out with just an announcement because this is a House room and this may not be a problem in the Senate, but apparently the recording, that we always announce this in House committees quite often, but the recording gets goofed up if there are people at the table or in the audience who have their cell phones on. It's harder to hear the recording. So if anybody does not have their cell phone off, if you could be sure to turn it off. And then that is what the plan is for the day. Any questions on that before we start with Sue Abderholden? Oh, I know. One other thing. Ms. Larson, Senator Salzman. Ms. Larson has a comment that she wants to make, and she wanted Senator Salzman to be sure to hear it because it regarded a question that you had yesterday. Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Salzman, yesterday you asked about the effect of the extracurricular charter school provision, and you specifically asked whether it implicated Minnesota State High School League athletic activities or not, and I said no, it did not, but in fact it does. I was wrong, and I would like you to know that the correct answer is it does implicate the Minnesota State High School League.
Madam Chair,
Senator Salzman.
And Senate Counsel corrected that within a couple of minutes, so not a problem because it is, it's worded very differently, so it is hard to determine, so not an issue at all, so thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have very honest staff, and I can't say I've ever caught Ms. Larson having to correct herself before, so it's a first that we can take note of. Okay, Ms. Abderholden. Welcome, and I know you're covering five conference committees, so that's why we want you to go early.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and as you know, mental illness affects all areas, so that's why I have so many conference committees.
Yes.
And I do have a handout for you as well. I just wanted to put this bill into context. And in the late 1990s, from around the country, we began hearing about reports about children and adults with disabilities being hurt and even some deaths due to the inappropriate use of seclusion and restraints in residential programs, day programs, hospitals, and more recently, schools. The federal government at that time actually stepped in and developed rules that applied to hospitals and residential programs. Minnesota, in turn, developed very strong rules for residential programs, including ones through the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections. And then last year, the legislature passed a law that governs community programs such as what we call CTSS, or Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, and day treatment. And I do want to note that that bill passed without any opposition. In January, there was a report issued by the National Disability Rights Network. It's a fairly lengthy one, so I didn't copy it for you. But it's called School Is Not Supposed to Hurt. And it's an investigative report on abusive restraints and seclusion in schools from around the country. Earlier this week, you probably also received some copies of a WCCO iTeam report. So this is, you know, this has kind of been a big issue in the community. And last summer, NAMI pulled together a group of experts and kind of on-the-ground people who work in the schools, particularly with kids who have serious behavior disorders. And what we wanted to do was to create a community consensus on how all programs serving children should use these procedures. We also knew that some school districts were working to obtain CTSS certification, so Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, through the Department of Human Services, and so we're going to have to be following those procedures that you passed last year. So as we developed the bill, we used actually last year's legislation as a guide, again, to try to create that community consensus. We then brought it around to numerous organizations. I presented at the MACE conference. People on the group really went out to everyone. And the bill has continued to evolve over this time. A few days before the House passed the bill in Representative Bradley's committee, we actually had an over four-hour meeting with over a dozen people walking through the bill, word by word, line by line, to make sure that everybody understood what it meant, and if there was disagreement, to try to create a consensus. So I think, as you can imagine, this was no easy task. This isn't exactly, I mean, it is a bit controversial, and it does raise a lot of issues for people, but I just want you to know that we did spend an inordinate amount of time making sure that everybody knew exactly what was being required. And while we don't necessarily have everyone jumping up and down and saying, oh, yes, we absolutely support this bill, we also don't have people saying that they oppose it. And I think with the controversial issue in the many years that I've been before you here at the Capitol, that's actually a pretty big thing. I want to spend just a few moments then actually walking you through the bill, and I thought if I used the side-by-side, just because that's what I had in my briefcase, and it starts on page R18. And at the very bottom of the page there, 136.28. I think the important thing to note here is that this is only applies for children with disabilities, children in special education. So this doesn't apply to, to any other kids that are in the school. If you turn to the next page, we have the list of definitions. The definitions, these actually took a lot of work. So you'll see that emergency, which is the only way that, you can use these procedures, is when it's needed to protect the child from hurting himself or others, or to prevent serious property damage. And the word serious is in there, so you don't want just a kid tipping over a chair to go ahead and use these procedures. We define physical holding, and we also defined what it's not, because we wanted to make sure that people knew this isn't if you're doing hand-over-hand guidance with a child, that's not considered physical holding. If you're doing a health-related procedure, whether a kid needs, insulin or, something like that you have to hold them down, that doesn't count. And if you're just escorting the child and there's no resistance, that doesn't count as physical holding either. We define restricted procedures, meaning just the use of physical holding or seclusion, and then we define seclusion. And I want to point out that we purposely did not use the word timeout, In the rest of the world in Minnesota, with all the other licensed programs, we use the word seclusion. Too many people have watched Nanny 911, and when you think about time out, you think about it in a chair in the kitchen. And we want people to know this is a very, very serious procedure. Just 2 months ago, a child in Georgia died in a seclusion room. He hung himself. This is a really big deal. And so we wanted to kind of relay the gravity of it. Plus the fact that we have a lot of children with mental illnesses who go between day treatment programs and schools. And in the day treatment program, they call it seclusion. So we wanted families to have an easy understanding, you know, using common terms so they kind of knew what was going on with their child. In the next section, we have the standards for research and procedures. And what we want is for schools to kind of develop how they're going to monitor this in this district. We know that you should monitor and review these because you don't want to use restrictive procedures or seclusion unless you really need to. You should do post-debriefing. So, you know, after it happens, you want to say, well, why did this happen? Is there a way that we could have prevented it? Because your goal is to not use seclusion and restraint. But as you can see, we didn't do a long list, and we're really allowing the school districts to develop whatever will work best there. On the next page, we talk about restrictive procedures. They can only be used by licensed, you know, teachers, school psychologists, licensed personnel who have also had special training. A lot of these programs, you don't really learn how to do seclusion and restraint properly as just part of your licensure, but we also want to make sure that people have a basis of education. Under B, we say that, you know, the school has to make reasonable efforts to notify the parents on the same day so that families can watch if there's some kind of distress that happens afterwards, particularly when you're using physical holding. We have two things in terms of schools looking at this. One is if it's not in the child's IEP and kind of out of the blue, you go to use a restrictive procedure and use it twice in 30 days or a pattern emerges. And I want to point out that when a pattern emerges is actually a phrase that's used frequently in the federal special education laws. So that's a phrase that we use a lot in special education. And it's not included, then you have the team come together. I want to make it very clear, the team does not come together every time a school uses this procedure. This is just initially if you use it twice in 30 days or a pattern emerges. And the reason for that is that it can be very dangerous to use these procedures with certain kids. If the child has severe asthma, you want to talk about that because you really shouldn't use physical holding. If the child has been, frankly, sexually abused, you don't want to use seclusion. So, you know, we understand that sometimes you have to use these in an emergency to protect the child or themselves or property, but if you start using it more frequently, you really need to hold that IEP team meeting to see if there's some other things going on.
And we have a question from Senator Bonner. Senator Bonner. Madam Chair, I remain quite concerned about this particular language, and we did not have an extensive hearing about it. I serve on the Autism Task Force, and I'm familiar with when you take an autistic child and you put them in seclusion, you're in many times really damaging that child. And so when we talk about when restrictive procedures are used, if it's not in the child's IEP, we talk about if you have not told a parent, I've actually had parents come to me and say that their child was placed in a restrictive room and that that is the absolute worst thing, that, you know, they actually set the child back a year from that experience and they weren't notified, they didn't know why their child had these symptomatic setbacks until they found out much later. And so I don't see that there's enough teeth in this language. I appreciate that you spent hours and hours and hours working on it, and I understand your commitment to make sure you're doing all you can for these young children, but I'm still not certain that the seriousness of some of these methods are reflected in the language. Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Senator, in the permission piece, in notifying, you have to notify the parents if you use these procedures.
Well, reasonable efforts.
Well, or, you know, that might mean, you know, you've not been able to reach them, but if you're not able to reach them, then you need to send out something, because we agree, I mean, that has been an issue. So a school shall make reasonable efforts to notify the parent on the same day, so the reasonable efforts is about the same day. And if the school is unable to provide same-day notice, notice is sent within 2 days by written or electronic means or as otherwise indicated by the child's parent.
Senator Bonner. Madam Chair. There's nothing in here that says the parent received it, that the parent has, I mean, sometimes you're dealing, when you're dealing with these kinds of children, you're often dealing with a home situation that is less than stable. And so there's still nothing in here that confirms the parent received the notice, that there's been communication between the parent and the school.
Senator Bonnet, you've got the perfect person to be answering your question because actually Ms. Aderholt is fighting on the side you're speaking for. And this is the compromise that they came up with. Last year, there were the department language, as you know, could not be passed because the intermediate schools said that that would shut them down. They could not deal with the violent students they had. No more protection in the law than that. So Ms. Aderholt has led the group of all the parties, and this is the result. Representative Mariani.
Sure, that was going to be my observation as well. I think we share the same concerns, Senator. I think what would be helpful for all members is to be able to look at the proposed language and compare it to what we currently have in statute. And I think what Ms. Aderholt and her group are doing is, in fact, moving away from a current status quo that I think very much raises the issues that you're concerned with. Obviously, at the end of the day, you know, you're talking about a bunch of stakeholders, you know, arriving at a very delicate balance point. But I think the intent is similar. The concerns are being addressed are similar, but I think your concerns are probably more aptly pointed at what's not working well with our current system.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, when you raise the intermediate schools, for an example, I think they do an unbelievable job in dealing with these tough situations. I'm actually raising them more about our public schools. I know that in our public schools, and I won't name them, they still do have these rooms that are used more than you'd like them to be. And I don't think that we're getting the kind of trained, you know, I hear what you're saying, and I hear the compromises that have been made. I'm uncomfortable. We'll see how this, you know, we'll see what my colleagues, where they go.
Ms. Aderholt, and then Senator Salzman.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonner, one of the problems we have in registering receipt is that it almost has to be, you know, that special mail where you sign off on it to know for sure that someone got it. You know, the premise is we put this together, and we firmly believe and have seen this in the community mental health programs as well, is that once you get people to actually get that special training, and once you get them to actually start documenting it, that people see this in a new light, and they're given new tools, and that and we actually see a decrease. We now have our state-operated community behavioral health hospitals, so, you know, our state institutions, who are committed to going to nearly a zero use of seclusion and restraint, and it was because of the training. So, I mean, we want to make sure parents are notified. This is an issue that's, you know, near and dear to Naomi's heart, but we realize the difficulty of trying to document that the family actually received it, but we know that you can document that you called or that you sent something, and so we thought that that was a good compromise in that respect and that we would see what happened after this goes into place.
Senator Salzman, and then Senator Representative Ward.
Sure, thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Aderholt, and thank you for your work on this. As we spoke last night, I was involved in some negotiations about, I think, a couple years ago when there were some concerns with the rulemaking process. So we are sort of going from a rulemaking process to really putting all of this into statute, which is another way of doing it. But I guess that some of the concerns, and as you know, the Senate did not hear this bill, so I think that we have some thoughts about it, is that in this, are we moving away from an instructional and behavioral approach with planned interventions to more of a reactionary response, and that we are moving more toward a mental health model than an educational, approach to this. How we go from using like a word like a timeout to like, you know, seclusion. And Some of the concerns, I think, is that because we are trying to educate kids and children are receiving special education services, that, you know, we're doing these things that, to hopefully also change behavior as opposed to just control it. So I think there will be some questions about how is this really addressing that. And I know that you've worked a lot with the stakeholders, but I think there's a sense of feeling comfortable just because it is very, very specific.
Madam Pearson, Ms. Saltzman, I think the important thing to understand here is that there is nothing in the literature, and I know how much you all like research, there is nothing anywhere that shows that the use of seclusion and restraint changes behavior. It does not. The only reason that these procedures should ever be used is to protect the child from hurting themselves or others. When you talk about uses of timeout, which is very different, which is really the removing the child from a rich, rewarding environment, that, in fact, does change behavior. But what we're talking about here is not timeout. If you'll notice, we do encourage schools to use the use of positive behavior intervention support, which is something that the Department of Education has pushed, which actually the federal stimulus dollars encourage schools to use that money to go in that direction, because that does actually, those procedures do help children learn different behaviors. And so I think it's important to really separate out the two, and I think that was the problem, frankly, with the rule that had been developed, is that it really didn't separate out the use of positive behavior interventions and what behavior interventions are, and then those procedures that actually have no research behind them in terms of changing behavior, but aren't really safety measures.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was an EBD teacher, emotional behavior disorder teacher, for a top of 34 years, but 22 of them was in EBD, emotional behavior disorders, and witnessed throughout those 22 years a number of procedures being used in a variety of different manners and a variety of different ways. I think this sets some standards and some procedures and some guidelines that are very good and very much needed, I think, as far as, levels of consistency and proper procedure. One of the things that, I know an IEP address, an individual educational plan, addresses behavioral interventions. And can you and I know that's in this bill, can you address that, please, Ms. Everholden?
Yes. Ms. Everholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, yes. In the very next section, so starting on lines, 138.15, in there, what we're suggesting is that, or stating, that the IEP team can actually plan for the use of these restrictive procedures, because we know that whether the child has autism or, some other type of, or another type of mental illness, like, bipolar disorder, you want to plan for an emergency, because we know for some of our kids that you have to do that. Families do that too. And so you can discuss it as part of the IEP team meeting. So, for example, if the family knows that this child has behaviors that they sometimes may hurt themselves or others, they will want to bring it up in the IEP team meeting so that they can plan ahead. But you can still only use them in emergencies, and I think that's an important part. You can't just say, well, if we instruct a child to do something and they don't do it, we can escalate the intervention up to, physical holding or seclusion. That wouldn't be right. But we do, again, allow you to talk about it on the team and plan for it, but not view it as a behavior intervention.
Okay. If there are no more questions, please continue, Ms. Abderholden.
All right. Then on 138.21, we talk about physical holding or seclusion. We say that this should be the least intrusive intervention that effectively responds to the emergency. So, you don't have to use this. You want to use something else to see if that works. That would be the proper thing to do. And this is an important one. The physical holding and seclusion must end when the threat of harm ends. So this notion that you wait 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and see if the kid calms down, no. As soon as that threat of harm ends is when the intervention ends. Now, the child may not necessarily go back to the classroom. We know that sometimes, a child is kind of exhausted and overwhelmed, and that may be, a little bit before they actually get back to the classroom or activity. But that seclusion or restraint ends when the threat of harm ends. We want to make sure that the staff are directly observing the child, especially in seclusion, because, again, children can hurt and injure themselves, and you want to be watching for that.
On the next page, each time it's used, the staff person who implements it or oversees it has to document it. I think that's very, very important for families to know, you know, how often this is used. And it's also good to know when you're trying again to really look at when it's been used, how it's been used, and if you can decrease the use in the future. And to help do that, you need to have a description of the incident leading up to it, you know, why something else less restrictive failed, the time that it began and ended, and then a brief record of the child's behavioral physical status, which I think is important, as any attorney will tell you, so that you can document that the child was breathing fine or whatever. We do have in here, which is in, has been in past rules about the room for seclusion. We want to again say it's got to be, it can't be a little, you know, room in the janitor's closet or anything like that. Has to be well lit, well ventilated. The thing that kind of threw things off in previous years is on line 139.10 about the locking mechanisms. What you don't want to have happen is for a child to be locked in a room, for someone to leave, and for, you know, a disaster to happen in the school and the child is left in there. So there's immediate release document mechanisms. It can be hooked into the fire and safety system so that they unlock automatically if that happens. And then the room, as it currently happens, would have to be registered with the commissioner so that the commissioner could check the room out if he or she needed to. And the next section is prohibitions, and I know this list looks really awful, but I actually worked on the original language that went into what was then called the aversive and deprivation rules in the 1980s. I was 15 at the time working on it.
You've been working all your life.
Yeah, that's right. And these are things, this is kind of consistent across the board with other types of laws and rules that we've had, including in education, that these are just the types of things that you just, you never use. And the next page on 140.1, I think this is a really important piece, and this is the training piece. We've worked, you know, extensively, for example, with police officers and learning ways to de-escalate a crisis situation. There are things that you can do that work much better than not doing them. Part of it, if, for example, when you talk to police officers, they come into a room where someone's having a mental health crisis, and they come in all big and strong and all that kind of stuff, loud voice, and that's like throwing gasoline on the fire. And so we want to make sure that people learn de-escalation techniques, so that you learn how to communicate and calm someone down, that you learn the communicative intensive behavior, which for children with autism is particularly important. They might be trying to tell you something. It's not that they're actually acting out or doing willful behavior. We want to make sure that they know the standards that will be, you know, set in place now for using the procedures, that they know the physiological and psychological impact of physical holding and seclusion, so they really understand the damage that can be done. That they understand how to monitor and respond to a child's physical sign of distress. The little girl you might remember in Wisconsin who died, they weren't recognizing that she wasn't breathing or having trouble breathing. And we specifically mentioned asphyxia because that is one of the dangers of physical holding. On 140.17, we would request that the commissioner, after consulting with the commissioner of the Department of Human Services, come up with a list of training programs. It's not that difficult to have it. I'm happy to copy it and give it to the commissioner, so we don't think that would require a lot of extra work. And we've also had a commitment from the Children's Community Mental Health Programs because they have to do the training in their facilities and programs. They've offered to do the training in conjunction with schools. Some of the intermediate districts have said they will offer training, you know, very low cost and cheap for other districts. And the state, the community behavior health hospitals, when I heard they were developing their own training, they said they would be happy to open it up to schools as well. Lastly, we, on the next page, we encourage school districts to really push for kind of the positive behavior interventions and supports, which I think would get at some of the issues raised today. We do note that this in no way prevents the reasonable force statutes from being implemented. You have something really dangerous going on, and we understand, you know, that that will sustain the effect. And then we don't put this in effect until August 1st, 2011, to really give school districts the time to get people to be trained, to put their procedures into place so that they can really monitor this. I think if you look at the federal kind of components that they've put together, this really does reflect best practice. If I was just to come in here alone and do this, of course, it would be far more over here. But I think it is a compromise. And I really do believe that if we provide the training, we require documentation, we make sure that parents are involved, that we will see a decrease in the use of these procedures. And in a few years from now, we won't be hearing stories from families about they didn't know or children being hurt or anything like that. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Ward, and then Senator Bonoff. And then we're going to ask, since this was a compromise and there are other groups involved and they're here in the room, if MSBA and the intermediates, if they could, and anybody else that wants to put in a word briefly, just so we can hear from the horse's mouth that we do have this compromise. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senators, I just want you to reference line 140.22, where it says subdivision 6, behavior support, and it also states school districts are encouraged. I just wanted to make sure that we saw that language in there.
Thank you, Representative Ward. Senator Baca.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Abder-Holden, thank you very much for the work that you've done on this and for the work that you do every day for the people who have mental health issues. And my concerns are not a reflection of that. I don't think that you've adequately done your work, but more a concern that is a seclusion room in a public school ever, can we be assured that it's used appropriately? Because we're talking about situations that are, you know, are moving and fluid and, you know, different people are coming into the situation who may or may not have had that training. And so I do remain concerned about that as a tool in a public school setting, as, you know, to be used. But I understand that it's there and that our kids have behaviors that for their own best interest we have to address. I still remain concerned.
Thank you very much. Of course, current law would be worse, so this is a step in your direction. Could I have Tom Dean and perhaps Valerie Goslin? Is there anyone else that wants to weigh in on this issue? All right, I think this will give a flavor of the groups that were involved. Welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Dean, and I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. Madam Chair, we have worked with Ms. Abder-Holden and her group on this. I would say that we've met on this maybe 40 hours this session, trying to get something that both sides are comfortable with and have thought through every aspect of this. MSBA is neutral on the legislation. We don't have an opposition position on the legislation. We're neutral. But there are a number of things that we had asked to be addressed that were addressed in the thing. For one thing, the planned use of these. If you've got a kid that potentially, even under his IEP, you know that he may go off and try to kill somebody else in the classroom, you may have to have this kind of a situation here so that you can protect the other people in the school. It's limited to an emergency. It's limited to the people that have training that can do this stuff. To address what I believe was the issue that was raised by Senator Saltzman, this doesn't address the concept of a timeout. If the kid is misbehaving or doing something in class and they get put over in another part of the classroom or they get put out in the hall or whatever teachers do, this doesn't address that. This only addresses using these restrictive procedures, putting them in the seclusion room, or doing the physical holding. So it doesn't address those sorts of things. I guess this isn't a perfect piece of legislation, but they never are. When we're here, we worked very hard on this. We think this was about the best that we could do. We're hoping that the training provisions don't become overly restrictive that are in here. One other, I guess while I'm here, I might as well take my my deal. The language in at 140.23, you've got that behavior support. We would like that second sentence, the one that starts with nothing in this section, we'd like that to be broken into a separate subdivision, a subdivision 7 that says reasonable force, so that if people, when they're looking for it, can actually find that language. And, you know, as Ms. Larson keeps telling me, the people have to be able to read these statutes. So that we think that that would be helpful. I guess I would just answer any questions that people have of me.
Thank you, Mr. Deans. And Ms. Anderholm talked to me about that ahead, and I think Ms. Larson knows about it, and Mr. McClay has now heard it as well. So it sounds reasonable. Any questions? Otherwise, Ms. Dolphin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doslin, and I represent the Intermediate School District. Just a little background. Sue Aderholzen approached me and the three intermediate superintendents late last spring about trying to come together in a working group to look at these issues. We met over the course of the summer and the fall, and as you recall, Tony Johns, the Special Ed Director in Intermediate 916, did testify. We appreciate the efforts, and we support this legislation.
Thank you very much. And last year, that wasn't your position, as I recall, Ms. Dolphin.
Well, last year, as I recall, it wasn't an issue in regards to legislation. There was a memo that was provided by, and my memory is very rusty, so I apologize. There was a memo or decision provided by MDE to Intermediate 916 regarding the use of their timeout rooms, and did not provide Intermediate 916 the opportunity to meet those requirements in a timely manner. And if I recall correctly, it was in the use of the locking mechanisms on the doors. But that issue was resolved, and then thus the working group started this summer.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, Brad Lundell here today on behalf of the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education. We have no formal position on this bill. We have members on both sides, but we do believe that Sue Aderholzen has done a marvelous job here, and that NAMI has really facilitated a discussion that does need to take place. As Tom Dean said, it's not a perfect bill, but I think it's a step in the right direction. You know, with that, I think that we'll just we thank the opportunity to speak, and we look forward to working in the future. I think the one thing that is good about this bill is it has the 2 years before it takes effect. The other thing, and I don't think that Ms. Aderholzen said this to the extent, one of the things with the federal stimulus package is the ability to use a lot of that money for special ed money for staff development, and we certainly would hope that this is staff development that's going to be in need, and as the legislature, as if this becomes law, that this is a great opportunity to use the stimulus dollars for, meaningful staff development for not only special ed teachers, but regular ed classroom teachers as well.
Thank you very much, and maybe Ms. Weber could include Minnesota's plans in her comments. Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Michelle Weber with the Department of Education, and we, of course, will be encouraging school districts to look at one-time expenditures with their federal stimulus funds wherever possible, and staff development would be a good place to invest those resources. Wanted to just make a comment for the record about the department's position on this language. We are fine with the language. Amy Roberts, the Director of our Compliance and Assistance Division, worked with the stakeholders as well on the language, and we appreciate further clarity within the statute around this issue. So.
Thank you very, very much.
Madam Chair, I'm Steve Larson, and I'm co-chair of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, which is over 100 disability organizations, as well as the public policy director for the ARC of Minnesota. And there is some perfection in this. This is a perfect consensus. And we want to thank Ms. Aderholzen for her hard work on this and all the other stakeholders. We participated in many of these discussions. We feel this is a major step in the right direction. The training and positive behavioral interventions not only benefit students with disabilities, but it also benefits all the other students in the schools as well as the teachers. Because once that type of process is implemented in the schools, it makes those schools safer for all people in those schools. And again, I want to just repeat what some of the former people have said. Ironically, after one meeting in which we kicked back the implementation of this 1 year, we came back to our computers and found a memo specifically from the federal government saying that those training dollars from the federal stimulus package should be used for this type of training. So now we have a 2-year opportunity for as many school districts as possible to take an opportunity of those dollars to look at implementing behavioral supports in their school, positive behavioral supports. Thank you very much for this opportunity to endorse this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Senator Saltzman.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just another follow-up, perhaps, for Ms. Adler-Holden. I'm looking on line 137.33, and this is in the staff who after training, would be able to use these restrictive procedures. And I'm seeing, you know, licensed special ed teachers, school social workers, school psychologists, behavior analysts, persons with a master's degree in behavior analysis, mental health professional, and then a paraprofessional under section 120B.363. And in looking in that section, obviously that, you know, we do have some qualifications for paraprofessional, but I guess I'm just questioning that when I look at all the other levels of education required for these other staff, they seem to have probably pretty extensive training in working with children with special needs. And I'm just wondering, I guess I'm a little concerned about then adding a paraprofessional. I understand that obviously they're oftentimes with students, but not having that background because, you know, essentially their qualifications are that they have a knowledge of reading, writing, and math. And obviously they have additional training, but I guess I question that a little bit. If we are going to move down this road, is it appropriate for them obviously to have a background, but to probably take action to initiate using a seclusion room? Do you have any comments or perhaps on that, or is that something that we might be able to discuss?
Ms. Adler-Holden.
Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman, I am not personally wed to that language. I have to remember in the many hours who brought that up to add the paraprofessional in there. You know, I think if the other groups are, you know, if they're not going to fall over on this, I'd be happy to delete that. Have usually said, but I need to look up the piece.
Ms. Adler-Holden, I can see the school boards want to talk to Senator Saltzman if she wants to delete that, so they may be the ones that brought it in.
After so many hours, you start to lose who brought what to the table.
All right, if there are no other questions, Ms. Adler-Holden, you can be on to your next conference committee, and thank you very much, and all the others who testified in the senators for bearing with us that you didn't have a chance to hear this in the Senate and all your thoughtful questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I guess, do we have the paperwork for the same and similars, or we do? Okay, why don't we do the same? And the Senate now is in the same situation as the House was last year. I think we have dueling spreadsheets, so we would certainly understand if you want to do what we did last night, which is take a minute with your people to go through the spreadsheets to make sure that you know exactly how they square up with yours and any previous discussions you may have had. And when Senator Weider gives me the word, we'll proceed.
Yes, Madam Chair, we would like to exercise that option to review that, and we'll return shortly.
Very good. Thank you.
Several provisions regarding homeschools, and I'd like to yield to Senator Olson to address that whole package.
Very good, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we would like to take that as a whole rather than as there are a few sections that are the same, and there's some that are different. But I think they need to be discussed as a whole.
Senator Olson, that makes sense. That's what we did with some of the special ed things last night. I think it makes, even though they're same and similar parcels, having it all together might make more sense for us and the public as well. So, all right, then we will pass on House Section 16, Senate Section 23. Senator Weider.
Madam Chair, the Senate concurs with Article 2, Section 17 in the House, and the Senate Section 25, and would move your recommendation.
So we're moving the Senate language then to Article 2, House Section 17, Senate Section 25. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. That section is adopted. Senator Weider.
Madam Chair, also at Article 2, Senate Section 26, House Section 18, same, we would so move.
Senator
Senator Wieger moves the Senate position for Article 2, House Section 18, Senate Section 26. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes, and that section is adopted. Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, for Article 2, Section 29, where you make the proposal, I believe there's a bit more clarification that's needed, and would ask staff to comment.
Ms. McClay.
Madam Chair and members, the difference here in House Section 29 and Senate Section 42 is on page R53 of Article 2. There is a this provision was a department recommendation, and there the House made one change, and maybe Ms. Larson can elaborate on that.
Ms. Larson. Ms. Larson, if you could use your microphone. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, on R53 of Article 2 of your House File 2, side by side, on 67.27 and 67.28 of the Senate, and this is consistent with the Department's recommendation, language regarding using research-based best practices for serving limited English proficient students and their parents is stricken. The House elected to reinstate the stricken language.
Madam Chair, could we ask the department to comment?
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Morgan Brown with the Education Department. My understanding of the deletion here is that it was a technical correction because this issue is covered in other statutes regarding using research and best practices for English language learners.
Thank you very much. Representative Mariani, do you want to comment at all on this House change compared to what the department recommended and what Ms. Larson has already stated?
Madam Chair, members, it did raise a red flag for me when we went through it. I'm not sure I fully understand it all, but it just seemed to me that to be able to strike research best practices in regards to LVP students, and didn't see the need to do that. So I was uncomfortable enough with it that we decided not to adopt the full language that the MD brought us in this regard.
And Mr. Brown stated that this exists another place. Does Ms. Larson or anyone know where that is, or maybe so Mr. Brown could tell us, if so that we can see where it is and see if Representative Mariani is comfortable with that, or whoever would like to address that.
Why do we...
Mr. Brown was saying that the department made a technical change. Rep. Mariani's concerned that it's substantive, and you said that we covered another place in statute. Could you tell us where that is?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Morgan Brown with the department. So let me just check with staff, and I'll come back to you on that.
Okay. I'm going to go on to another one while they do that.
Sure. Madam Chair, for Article 2, on the background check, House Section 31, we had a question regarding the cost, and it's not clear on the House position as to who ultimately would pay.
Madam Chair?
I'm sorry, Mr. Norman?
Yes, I think the issue that the Senate struggled with is that under the background check language that's being added, it provides a permissive authority for under both bills for a school hiring authority to pay for the cost of conducting a background check. The Senate had a substantial amount of conversation with it, reinstated the stricken language because in the event that a school chooses not to pay for it, the burden in the Senate's view needed to remain with the individual. So the default is to the individual, but a school hiring authority could choose to pay for it if they so chose. So that was the issue that the Senate that was the background for why the Senate reinstated the stricken language. In the absence of that stricken language, if the language were stricken, it would not be clear if a school district chose not to pay for it, who would pay for it.
Okay. And this was Representative Detmer's bill in the House, and I don't... Representative
Mariani,
are you trying to get in here?
No. Well, Madam Chair, we've got staff looking at it carefully. I do see the logic of the argument, though. I think on the part of the Senate that, you know, you've got a new language here that says, you know, so this is the order of things. You have the responsibility of the individual, and then you've got, after that, then you've got a district that can elect to...
Yeah.
To do that, so I think I'm following that, but I just want to make sure we're not doing any damage here. If you can give me a minute.
Okay. Ms. Larson?
Madam Chair, members, I think the difficulty is clarifying that there is an exception to the general principle. So the general principle is that the cost of the criminal background check is the responsibility of the individual, unless the school hiring authority decides to pay the cost, in which case the individual need not pay. So I think we have to state what the general principle is and then state what the exception. And in this case, the exception is when a school hiring authority decides to pay the cost. So if we were to take the Senate language, I think we have to amend it slightly to say that the cost of the background check is the responsibility of the individual unless the school hiring authority decides to pay the cost under this paragraph, blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair.
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, Ms. Larson, are you suggesting just that clause in front of the A on the Senate language, unless...
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, on 70.1 of R55, I would recommend striking the period, inserting unless, delete may, decide, and insert decide. So that 70.1 would read, the responsibility of the individual unless the school hiring authority decides to pay the cost.
Okay, so Senator Rieger, the change then being proposed is that we would take the Senate language and amend line 70.1 so it says the responsibility of the individual unless the school hiring authority decides to pay the cost.
Now it's so moved.
Senator Rieger, so moved. Any discussion or questions on that? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion passes and the section is adopted. Senator, let's see, are they ready with that? No. Let's go on to the next one.
And Madam Chair, for Article 2, Section 50, Senate Section 77, under eligible pupils, we wanted a little more clarification from MSBA, Mr. Chair.
All right. If we could have Mr. Dean or Ms. Kelleher on Article 2, Section 50 of the House.
Madam Chair and members, while the School Boards Association is looking at this, the change that the Senate has on 100.12 is the language would read, has been appropriately referred in accordance with Section 124D68, Subdivision 1. The House has been referred by a school district for enrollment in an eligible program. Ms. Larson brought up the point yesterday that the reference is to 124D68, Subdivision 1. And that's the purpose section. There may be a need to clarify the Senate language to just point to 124D68 and strike the subdivision reference.
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, I'm not quite certain what you gained because you're amending 124D68. You're in that section.
Ms. McCray. McCray. Or maybe we'll wait to hear from MSBA. They're looking puzzled as well. How about if we let them have some time and press on to the next one? So we'll pass on Article 2, Section 50 of the House and 77 of the Senate, and go on to Article 2, Section 60.
Yes, and Madam Chair, I believe the next four are homeschool provisions, which we wanted to do as a package, as mentioned earlier. And we went next to... There's none in Article 3, I believe. So if we went to Article 4, keeping in mind we're going to return to a couple. At House Section 7, Senate Section 5, you have the reference to review and comment, but in the side-by-side that you presented, the reference is to consultation, and we need to, I think, better align the language. And I'm not sure if it's stated correctly on the reference to the Senate file on the $500,000 to a million. It might have been a different amount, but I'll ask the staff to elaborate further.
Ms. McQuay.
Madam Chair, on page R4 and R5 of Article 4, there are two provisions that deal with the consultation and review and comment for facilities. The House does not have the consultation provision, which increases the threshold limit from $250,000 to $500,000, and that's what's referenced on the same similar spreadsheet. There is, however, a similarity between the review and comment on R5 and the review and comment in the Senate section. Both the House and Senate increase the threshold from $500,000 to $1.4 million for school districts that don't have a capital loan outstanding. There is some wording differences, and I think the House would have had a little more time to look at that, and that may be a little clearer there. But if you go down then to 154.13 to 154.15, this is language that's in the House that's not in the Senate. And requiring an exemption from a review and comment for facilities maintenance projects funded with capital facilities bonding or alternative facilities bonding or health and safety revenue. And I think the Senate just needed some clarification on which Senate and House sections matched up there.
Clarification, Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, my apologies for the mismatch on the side-by-side. In terms of the last issue on the review and comment, the language that was added on lines 154.13 through 15 was at the request of the department. The department suggested they would assign a fiscal note to increasing the amount of the review and comment. Their argument was that more one-day bond sales would occur by the maximum effort school loan districts, and as a result, but just raising the limit from $500,000 to $1.4 million would carry a fiscal impact. So this was relatively at the last minute when this was brought up in the House, and the House put a provision in exempting the maximum effort districts from the higher limit. So the maximum effort districts would still be subject to the $500,000 limit.
Madam Chair, the Senate language carries that for the same rationale that Mr. Strom just cited. The Senate carried that same language also at the last minute. I think the question for the Senate relates to the House language 154.13 through 154.15, which offers what appears to be an exemption for a variety of facilities projects from the review and comment.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, my eyes are failing me this morning. Those provisions were from part of Representative Pillsbury's bill having to do with the mandate reductions. And essentially what happens is this relieves the requirement for review and comment on projects that are otherwise reviewed by the commissioner.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll continue to think about that one.
All right. Do you want to come back to it, or do you want to pass on it for today?
Pass on it today.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, on the Article 5 for budgets, form of notification in Section 1 in the House and Section 3 in the Senate, we have some provisions in our tax bill as well, and we were checking that. Mr. Nauman, if you have any additional information.
Madam Chair and members, it's my understanding that both the House and Senate tax bills eliminate the truth in taxation hearing process. And the Senate bill, the Senate language here, Section 3 of Article 5, does not include the striking of that reference. This might be one of those things that we would normally pick up in a subsequent year. If members assume that the language that appears in both tax bills is likely to become law, you could include the House position safely on that basis, or you could wait and include the Senate position. Both bills seem to, both House and Senate K-12 bills carry a summary reference. The House language is a little bit more specific, including a reference to a website.
So you want to kind of hang loose on that one, see what the tax committee is doing?
Madam Chair, that was not my suggestion. I just hesitate to, I was suggesting that more as informational disclosure. You could do it now, and or you could.
Okay, well then, Senator Wieger and Senators, I would move the Senate portion, which is the same, and then we can decide about the other later, but the Senate language for Article 5, Section 3. Any discussion on that motion? All in favor say aye. Opposed? Passes, and that article, Article 5, Section 3 of the Senate language is adopted. Senator Wieger.
Yes. Madam Chair, I believe on the next couple on the accounts and transfers we wanted to hold for now.
All right. Senator Wieger.
And one moment.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, I'm sorry, members, are we on Article 6?
Article 6.
Article 6, the distribution of appropriation, which begins on R2 and is mostly on R3. The House has language that includes permanent supportive housing, and I think the Senate wanted some further clarification on that wording difference.
Okay, so Senator Wieger. Before we go to the motion, Senator Mariani.
Madam Chair, I was just trying to find my notes, but clearly both the House and the Senate are trying to create some exemptions and reporting in terms of highly vulnerable families that could be served by these programs. And so we're clearly talking about homeless families in transitional housing. The permanent supportive housing are obviously these aren't homeless families. Is this the same provision? Okay. These aren't homeless families, but nonetheless highly vulnerable families receiving chemical, usually chemical dependency or some other health disability. And so they're in an extended period of time living as whole families in these supportive arrangements for an extended period of time until such time as they can get back on their feet. And so we really are, they're not the same population, but they really, I think, speak to the same intent, both the House and the Senate here, in terms of opening up that opportunity for these somewhat transient family groups.
Thank you. Senator Bynum.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, we
support the intent behind that language. The question that we had, because we hadn't seen that language before, is do we think that will affect how many children will be served in terms of the homeless population? Will we still have the reach that we're looking to accomplish? How will that affect the overall numbers?
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonner, I don't know the answer in terms of quantity of people, but it's not at all unusual to see a movement of folks from transitional or from, you know, a shelter into these permanent supportive. We try to do that as quickly as possible, particularly for those with these kind of disabilities. So you might wind up catching families that you're serving, I would imagine, in the first group, but can quickly wind up in the second group.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani. Thank you, Madam Chair. We do appreciate that, because I think, you know, ultimately what we're looking for is to support our families to have permanent housing. So it seems that that is in line with that intention.
Mr. Harris, do you have a comment on this topic?
Yes, Madam Chair. Chef Harris here on behalf of the Family Supportive Housing Provider Group. Worked with Head Start on this language, and it was a timing issue, frankly, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We got the language in time for the House bill versus the Senate, where we didn't, and I think Representative Mariani did a good clarification of what permanent supportive housing is. It's more inclusive, so we'll be able to catch everyone, and homeless children would be excluded, so we'd encourage the Senate to accept this.
Thank you very much. Senator Weaver.
We would so move the House provision.
Senator Weaver moves the House provision of Article 6, Section 2. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes and the section is adopted. Senator Weaver.
Madam Chair, I'd like to yield to Senator Bonner on the quality rating proposal.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, there's the two major differences in this, and so because Representative Slawik isn't here, I suspect we should probably hold off, but the House puts the word voluntary in several places, and the Senate is comfortable with that it is a voluntary program, and so putting the word in is no problem. However, we in the Senate did set aside some base funding for the quality rating system, and the House provision, I do not believe, does that, and so I think it to just adopt that language might not be the best direction right now, and perhaps Representative Slawik and I could talk about that later.
That sounds very good. However, as far as how the voluntary got to be in there, we could answer that question for you right now, because the person who's responsible for that is Representative Ward. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and actually this came from a number of providers that really see a quality rating system as a positive kind of movement in child care and quality care for our young people, but were concerned that they wanted to have the word voluntary in there, so it was clear that it was voluntary, and the language that, as you said, Senator Bob, you know, is makes it voluntary without the word voluntary in there, but they wanted to clearly have that word in there to make it very, very clarified.
Thank you. Thank you. And we'll wait on that section then. Senator or Representative Slawik will be here at the next meeting, I believe. Senator Weaver.
Madam Chair, at Article 7 for grants and gifts, wanted to see if there's any testimony on the department. Or, you know, I believe the House, it's a report, in the Senate it would be a list. And get a little more information as to
Ms. Weber.
The distinction.
Okay. Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and members, Michelle Weber with the Minnesota Department of Education. And this language the department actually brought forward at the request of the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget, just to provide clear statutory authority for the department to receive gift-type funds, which might be funding from a foundation or that type of nature, non-federal or state funding. In terms of the reporting on it, we do not see it problematic because we do have to account for those types of funds, so either version would be fine.
Thank you very much. And the House version, just so members and the Senate know, came in the way the Finance Committee from our Ways and Means Chair. He said that's common procedure, and he thought we should just make sure we have that information for how the money is collected.
Madam Chair, I'll move the House provision.
Senator Wicker moves the House provision in Article 7, House Section 1. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Article 7, House Section 1 is passed.
And Madam Chair, in Article 7, there's reference that you would have an amendment to the Senate language, and if we could see that.
Ms. Larson?
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Wicker, the only thing that seems to be missing in the preferred Senate language is a reference to whom the report should go. And so the recommendation would be to say to the Education, Policy, and Finance Committees of the Legislature.
Senator Wicker?
Yes, we would amend the language to reflect that and would so move.
Senator Wicker moves Article 7, the Senate language, as amended in Senate Section 2. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. That the section is adopted. Senator Wicker.
Madam Chair, perhaps if anyone is able to come forward on the items we passed over.
We go back to those, and then let's remember to go to Article 10. Okay, we passed over the first one. We were looking for Mr. Brown, and it looks like he is now ready. Article 2, Section 29 in the House, on page R53. Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Morgan Brown with the Department. I apologize, I haven't been able to get clarification on that provision, so if the concern of the committee members is that taking that sentence out would have a substantive impact, go ahead and, you know, leave it in. My memory was that it was duplicative of another area, and that was why we were taking it out.
Madam Chair, I'll move the House position.
Senator Wicker moves the House position for Article 2, House Section 29. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion passes, and that section is adopted. Senator Wicker. Senator Wicker, we were wanting to go back to School Board Association for Article 2.
Or the department.
Or was that the department?
Could be.
Okay. As long as he's up there. Article 2, Section 50 in the House.
Madam Chair, my understanding of this, the reason for the additional language that is in the Senate bill but not in the House bill, is that there was some concern about districts inappropriately referring students under this statute who did not meet the criteria of being an at-risk student but were students that couldn't fit in all their courses within a normal schedule, and so they're being referred to be able to add extra courses because, of course, the alternative program can do 1.2 ADM. And so it was to try to clarify that this program, this statute, really is reserved for at-risk students as opposed to students that are on an accelerated track of taking additional courses.
Okay, so this is language you...
Right, yes, Madam Chair. That the department's language was the Senate language in that case.
All right. Ms. Larson?
Madam Chair, members, you have a cross-reference whole purpose statement.
And Mr. Brown, that was Ms. Larson's comment in the first place, you may remember, on R-102, Senate Language 100.12, that in accordance with Section 124D.68 is the section of law that is being amended, so that it doesn't make any sense to be redundant about that. Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, if that's the feeling of the committee staff, that because this is all within the same section, it's being redundant, then this is just an attempt to clarify this issue that had come up with some districts.
So, Mr. Brown, you'd be fine with the House language then?
That would be fine, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Wicker.
I would so move.
Senator Wicker moves Article 2, House Section 50. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes, and that section is adopted. And we're now down to the last section on the list, which is Article 10.
I'm sure.
Oh, is there another one?
Article 5, Section 15.
Article 5, Section 15.
R32A. I don't know
that
if we took action.
That was one you said you wanted to skip along with the others, but if you want to do it, that would be great.
Yeah. It was inadvertent, and we would like to move that.
All right. So Senator Wieger moves Article 5, the Senate language in Senate Section 31. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Ms. McQuaid.
I'll just make a point of clarification that the side-by-side language is not matched up here. You'll find the Senate language, which is identical to the House in Article 3, which is R32A3. So if you, if it is the recommendation to adopt the Senate language, we should probably go to R32A3. Article
3. There is no page in, there's not, that's one of those pages in our, in Article 5 on the House side. Article 3, page 32. Section 31, or is that I'm looking for the page?
Page 32.
There is no page 32 in Article 5. In Article 3, there is right here. But I couldn't find the house. Because it's not on that page.
They're going to pull
it's, okay, that's fair enough, because there weren't that many pages yet. So it's the same thing. It's, but it's in a different location. How come you didn't pitch that with the thing with them?
Okay. So there, we're back to your motion, apparently.
Article 3, Section 31 of the Senate would be moved.
Senator Wieger moves Article 3, Section 31 of the Senate. The Senate language, any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. That section is adopted. And then on to any others before we go to the final Section 10, Senator Wieger.
No, Madam Chair, it's Section 10 and forecast.
Section 10 it is. And this is one we wanted to have a little discussion on so we're all clear what this is. Did one of you guys want to start with this? Okay. Mr. Searle.
Madam Chair and members, Article 10 is the forecast adjustment. What happens is you'll see the appropriations are all changes to fiscal 2009. When a forecast is put out, we know that the appropriations we wrote last session are wrong, so we adjust those appropriations to meet the new forecast. And the House bill only, or primarily includes only those changes that result in increases relative to the end of session appropriations. And the reason for that is because in the past, when we've made reductions and then the subsequent forecast comes out without an ability for the legislature to adjust those appropriations, programs that were intended to be fully funded by the legislature were prorated because the appropriation was reduced. The House wants to avoid proration as much as possible. And in some cases, the appropriation, even without a change, might be insufficient, so there might be a proration but the House bill makes an effort to avoid proration in the cases where the legislature has to adjust an appropriation. So chose to avoid appropriation reductions in the cases where there could be proration in the future.
And so as education advocates all around this table, we hope you would see the wisdom of the House position here.
Thank you. Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair and members, I think the Senate's perspective on this was that the education forecast adjustment article should be a technical article that reflects the forecast as accurately as possible. So the Senate chose, as has been the past for 10 plus years or so, to continue its practice of reflecting both the uppers and the downers so that the article as closely conforms as possible to the forecast as the dollars were known at the time that the forecast was made.
So we leave it to any questions from the senators. The House, you know, we're very much not liking our funding to erode through these types of forecasts.
Madam Chair, I believe the Department of Finance is...
Madam Chair and members, Management and Budget does have some concerns about the House position. We would prefer the forecast article remain as it has historically been, which is technical and non-controversial and conforming with the forecast as was released in February. Our concern is because the forecast has provided the baseline historically, and we're concerned about deviating from that.
So you would prefer the Senate language. We are noted and informed by our staff that there have been forecasts. It's not something new and different that the House is proposing. There have been forecasts adjustments, statutes passed that only include the increases. So it's an option, wouldn't you say?
Madam Chair, members, it is an option that the legislature could choose to do. Management and Budget would prefer that it conform with the forecast. One of our concerns is that as a result of this forecast language, we adjust the appropriations in the accounting system to reflect this bill as the legal authority for those appropriations, and so this would give legal authority for spending beyond the forecast level.
Madam Chair.
What?
Senator Stump.
Madam Chair, I think before I move the Senate position, I think we have gotten into a lot of discussion this year about trying to do honest budgeting and looking at getting back on track in terms of our budget. And yesterday in the fiscal policy and planning, meeting, you know, we talked about trying to understand exactly where the executive branch stood and the House stood and we stood. So I think it would be wise to kind of try to keep the as much of the technical stuff technical, and realizing that there are going to be some fluctuations with the forecast. But I reflect back on what we did with inflation, whether inflation is in or whether only revenues, I mean, whether we count inflation or don't count inflation. And it was a time when, I guess it was to our advantage, the legislature's advantage, to make it look like the budget wasn't going to be quite as severe, so we didn't count inflation. But it really put us in a awkward position in terms of how we consistently look at budgeting, and I would try to encourage all of our House members and Senate members that budgeting should be it's to our advantage if we're very upfront about it in the long run. And I know sometimes in the short run it's a plus, but I think in the long run, the more honest and straightforward we can be, the better. The same holds true with the ship and the governor's proposed borrowing. We did that back in 2004, I believe, with the transportation, and we paid the price in the following years. And so I really think that it's, I would encourage us to stay with the way we are doing it right now.
And Senator Stump, as you know, I strongly agree with you about SHIP. I strongly agree with you about counting inflation on one side of the ledger and not the other side, and we can't get ourselves to write that. But this one we see as different in the House position, because it's not just an accounting gimmick and a mirage, but, you know, as our staff has explained it to us, it's actually by having the option to prorate things that end up in reductions in following budget years, is having, it's a real, it's not a, just a trick or a mirage. It really is eroding away our funding, because once things are prorated, then they're actually reduced in the next forecast. And that is taking a toll over time on the money that we have available for students. So I think we'll, it sounds like we'll beg to differ on this one. That will, you know, maybe we can get some more information. But it's, you know, I think this is not in the same category as those others. This is a real difference, and it's hurting us. And, you know, maybe to help us decide what to do, if Ms. Raton could get us some information on the other budgets and how they handle the forecast. And, pardon me? Well, I'd be interested in the other budgets as well. You know, would this be out of sync with every other budget, or do some of the others do it the other way, then they don't suffer as much as we do? But the other request then would be what has happened when we've had the type of language in the forecast adjustments that the Senate has here and that we've done, and what impact has that had on the funding that we end up with then, because of the proration and then the subsequent reduced forecast. If we could have some more information, maybe that could help us see our way clear to see what we should do here.
Madam Chair, I can certainly consult with NDE about what's happened historically, and also with our Health and Human Services budget officers about the adjustments in their articles.
Thank you very much. Any other? So we are not going to act on this one. We don't have any other same or similars. So I had a couple questions for the Senate before we go to Ms. Jocelyn as the first person that's asked to testify. It's kind of come up with the truth in taxation topic, that, you know, we have some things in this bill and then they're also in the tax bill. And there's three topics that we also wanted to discuss and see if we could agree, or at least figure out how we're going to decide if they should be in this bill or other bills. And one of them is the 216 topic that's in this committee for the Senate, but in higher ed for the House. And I did, we checked with some people, and, you know, it'd be our preference for that topic to go with the Senate position, and, you know, have our staff make the arrangements to have that happen, communicating with the other committee, if that's all right with you. And then the other two we wanted to discuss were pupil transportation and the boiler operator language. But first, the T20, wondering if you'd be fine to have that in this committee.
Yield to Senator Stump.
Senator Stump.
Madam Chair, the House division has it in your K-12 or E-12 in this bill, right?
Mm-hmm. Which is it? Do we have it in here? Yeah. Which, it's us that has it. Oh, it's us. Okay, well then you have it in higher ed. So it would be the our preference then to have the house position. I got it backwards.
I think it last year was in the policy committee, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was in the bill that, Madam Chair, Senator Trump, it was in a bill that was vetoed.
So it has passed out of both parties.
And Senator Stump and others, we're thinking that it's P-16 or P-20, so it's early childhood through grade 12, and then there are the other higher ed grades, but that, you know, most of it does relate to K-12 or E-12.
Senator Stump. Maybe what could help us to be is if, do we have the P-20, are there any other issues that are being negotiated? I know the tax committee has a couple provisions. One of them is the truth in taxation. Another one is the
OPEB.
So if we could make a list, maybe we could ask staff to make a list of all of the items that we try to figure out that should be in the jurisdiction here.
So
and where they are.
Senator Stump, you'd like it, and I think that would be fine to have the staff try to come up with a more exhaustive list, and we could consider that comprehensively at our next meeting. We just wanted to get those issues out that we need to resolve them at some point. And the others, besides the ones you mentioned, truth in taxation, OPEB, P20, then we also had on our list the pupil transportation that we have in this bill, but in the Senate, it's in the transportation committee. Like we said, when we went through the side-by-sides, the House decided to keep it in our bill because we had the trouble with the Type 3 buses last time, and we wanted to be responsible for our own mistakes if there were any, rather than be lambasted by another committee's work. And then the boiler operator language that we have in this bill, and I believe you have a separate bill that's somewhere.
It's passed off the Senate floor.
Mr. Nauman has already passed. So okay, let's have the staff put those on the list and anything else that they can come up with, and we can talk about those on Monday. So the last thing then are the people who have asked to talk, and Ms. Doslin, is she here? And then I also had possibly Tom Dean, if he's still interested, unless that issue that I think you wanted to talk. And then is there anybody else? Mr. Bartholomew is kind of a... So those three, and is there any... If we'll ask it after that if there's anyone else. Ms. Doslin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doslund, and I represent the Minnesota Community Education Association. And I'd like to talk about two provisions that you discussed at some length last night that are in the Senate bill. The first one is the requirement for school readiness programs to serve children a minimum of 12 hours. Although the Community Ed Association and early childhood educators do not disagree with the research, and to the extent that funds are available, they would be ecstatic to be able to serve children in their school readiness programs for a minimum of 12 hours. We have a lot of concerns because that provision is unfunded, and I've been hearing from school readiness programs all across the state that this will result in less children being served. And we are very appreciative of the House and Senate's efforts to prevent cuts to early childhood. This provision will directly result in less children being served. And this will not only affect programs in rural Minnesota, it will also affect programs in the suburbs. I've heard from Wayzata, South St. Paul, Shakopee, Eden Prairie, Anoka Hennepin, and some of the information I've been receiving said that they will be able to serve half the number of children that they are currently serving. One of the other issues with that provision is the effective date. School readiness programs right now are currently enrolling students in their school readiness programs for next year, and should the effective date be as it is in statutes, which I believe it would be August 1st or June 30th, they would have to tell these families that they would not be able to serve those children, and they would also have to decide which families to serve. Another provision that I'd like to talk about is the requirement in the provision in the Senate bill
requiring or changing the threshold in which districts must hire a licensed community ed director. Right now, current statute allows an exception to the requirement if you have a population in your school district of less than 2,000, and the Senate provision changes it to 4,000. The Community Ed Association has concerns about that for a number of reasons. First of all, we think it's unnecessary. There is currently in statute the ability for districts to request a waiver from the Board of Administrators if they cannot find a qualified individual. We also think it will have a negative impact on the quality of the community ed programs in the state. Community ed directors are required. Their license is based on having specific competencies in administration as it directly relates to community education. And it also, community ed directors are required by state law to monitor and maintain community ed funds reserve, and they are specifically and specially trained for this kind of financial oversight. And the last, another point I want to make is Decision Resources polling firm recently did a survey, and it shows that people who participate in their community ed programs are more likely to support their local referendum, and we have concerns thinking we believe that this provision would affect the quality of the community ed program. And lastly, just some statistics for you. Since 2003, 35 school districts above the 2,000 mark have requested a waiver, and some districts have requested duplicate waivers in subsequent years. There have been a total of 64 requests, and of those requests, over half have been 38 requests have been approved, and 24 have been denied, and the rest were either tabled or withdrawn. So we think this is trying to address a concern that isn't out there, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your time and your hard work.
Thank you very much. Ms. Urbana.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Joslin, with regard to your concern on the 12 hours, in addition, both the House and Senate bills and the department put forward that we wanted to ensure staff-child ratios of 1 to 10 and a maximum group size of 20 children with the first staff required to be a teacher. Is that a mandate that you consider also unfunded, or is there any concern about that?
Senator Bonner, they did not raise any concerns when the education policy bill came out early in, or the department policy bill came out early in session. It was the school readiness 12-hour minimum that they are most concerned about.
Madam Chair, Ms. Olson, one of the things I just wanted to bring to your attention is we have these early childhood allowances, and we allow the families to use a $4,000 allowance towards putting their child in a high-quality preschool experience. In order to put their child in that, you know, to qualify for that, we want to make sure that the place where the child is going to be meets all the requirements of quality. And so I think that's where the school readiness people have said they want to make sure that they are candidates for placement for those families who get the scholarships. And so that's really where the dilemma comes. They specifically, and I reached out to those school readiness people, we want them in that group of early childhood providers. But we've been very clear with the rest of the provider community of what it takes to get a 3 or 4 star rating. And so I think that's something that we'll have to solve as this question gets discussed as we go on.
Ms. Goldflin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Bonner. I appreciate your comments. One thing I'd like to point out is the requirement that was proposed by MDE requires all school readiness programs, whereas the allowances as they are proposed in the Senate bill only reach out to a certain number of counties, would not be statewide, nor would they be for all early childhood programs statewide.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Urbana.
Ms. Dilsman, that's noted, and I think that's something to discuss.
Any other questions or discussion from members? Okay. Hearing none. Thank you, Ms. Goldflin. Mr. Dean.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Dean. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. What I'm having passed out and we provided this to the chairs and the staff earlier this morning, is a joint recommendation from MSBA on behalf of the school districts and from NAMI on behalf of the special ed advocates on the special education provisions that are in the bill that you haven't, at least the ones you haven't already done. You've done some of the same to revise this. What we basically put down is the provisions that that we would recommend that you adopt, and there's a couple of additional provisions that I'd like to sort of explain what we're doing. On the third recommendation, you have already adopted House Section 3, and we're requesting that you make two more basically technical amendments to that section. The next recommendation, we don't support the provisions of Senate Section 5. That's the definition of LEA. And this was the types of things that you had Mr. Crow and stuff was going through earlier today, where there were stuff where you had things in about the LEA that was in the existing House language. We tried to solve this problem this session, and we really ran out of time. We met with the department about this. The department has agreed that there is a problem here, and they would like to have the opportunity to work on this summer. We have so many odd situations in Minnesota because of all our open enrollment and all our enrollment options and things as to who's the district that's responsible. And that's we couldn't deal with it in this bill. But the Senate provision basically has a definition of LEA. We would like to get more of a comprehensive provision on that. The next recommendation would delete the provisions that are in Section 6 of the House bill. And this is the one where we had tried to work on doing this fix and saying who is going to be responsible, and we ran out of time. So what we have come up with is substitute language that's been approved or that's been recommended by both us and the advocates, and has been approved by the department. That basically takes out the obsolete provisions that are in 125A03. That's basically what Clause A does. Clause B deals with the age issues that we had reached agreement on. Clause C deals with when a district places a kid in a private school, it's their placement, they put that kid in there, it makes it clear that paying for that special education remains the obligation of that school district. Clause D basically specifies what the federal law says as to how federal funds flow when a kid's voluntarily enrolled in non-public schools. Going on, we continue with recommendations. Many of these recommendations, lest Representative Greiling gets irritated with me, are Senate recommendations, but it only goes to the fact the language is really the same in both bills, but you did it differently because the Senate repealed provisions where you weren't where you were just deleting them all out in the House, and we think the Senate probably did that correctly. If you look at the recommendation on Senate Section 13, 14, and 16, Senator Fulby's bill, Senate File 1800, got sent to the Judiciary Committee, and they made some changes, and those changes are incorporated in here, and this would incorporate in the changes that were made by the Senate Judiciary Committee. On the repealers that are in at the end of the bill, we would on the House side, we would adopt all the House repealers at least in Clause A, except for 125A03, because that one is being amended in that amendment to Section 6. That would include the repealer of the shared time special ed provision. That's 125A18. I know that has some controversy among some people. It would also pick up all the repealers that are in the Senate bill. Then the last thing is that we would want to make all the special education changes effective July 1, 2009. Other than if you adopted that the stuff that Sue Adlerholden was discussing this morning, that would be effective August 1, 2011, including the repealers that went with that. So that would be our recommendation for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. And this is just such a service to us that you gathered all the players that did the great work that we had before us in the Senate and the House to begin with, and now have come to consensus again. I can't begin to tell you what progress has been made in the issue of special ed, clarifying, having less mandates, but yet having what is there working better for the actual students. To you and all the players in this very important work, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair,
I wonder if we couldn't ask staff to put this in all of the special ed stuff in a hard copy for the conferees on Monday, so that we could look it over and then maybe we could take it all up on Tuesday.
Senator Stumpf, Monday or Tuesday, Senator Weaver and I, while we were just informally gathering here, thought there were several big topics that we could do Monday or Tuesday. And since you will have the gavel on Monday, it's your choice. So if you don't pick this one for Monday, it will be Tuesday.
Well, Madam Chair,
I thought we
obviously could use this, but if we had a hard copy that we could look at on Monday, and have, you know, maybe all of the key players come together on Tuesday, we could adopt it. I mean, if there's a consensus on it.
Senator Stumpf, I think that's a fantastic idea. This is important work that we should get in there, and if we can do it early and there's 3 months and we get the staff to work in, that's all to the good. Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does NAMI support the repeal of 125A18?
NAMI is not still here, but maybe Mr. Deans could speak because this has been a coalition work. Mr. Deans.
Madam Chair, I sort of wish Ms. Adlerholden were here, but they do. And that provision was also a unanimous recommendation of the Special Ed Task Force that you sent out and had worked on this issue for the last 2 years. In fact, it was, I think, the only unanimous recommendation from that task force. But NAMI is has signed off on that.
Senator Olson, can you? Thank you very much. And I'm sure by Monday or Tuesday, Sue Adlerholden can be able to verify that as well. Okay, Mr. Bartholomew is in the audience, and he has passed out on behalf of the Minnesota Business Partnership a handout with positions, and he said he will pass on testifying today and would like to do that another time when we get a little closer and we have just general testimony from groups. Bartholomew, yes. So, Representative Ward.
I'm sorry, could I go back to the previous testify one time? And I'll just talk with my colleagues here. Can you tell us, you referenced, and this is a great document, thank you very much, you referenced on almost all of them, same as House Section 9, Subdivision 12, whatever. You know, the ones that the reference includes changes from the Judiciary Committee? Is there any House reference there? Help me, teach me about that, will you?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Ward, the language, to tell you the truth, the language is, it does the same thing in both bills. It's in the House bill as well. But what happened is when it went to the Judiciary Committee, they decided they'd rewrite it a little bit and move some of the stuff around. I don't believe, but at least it's my feeling, that it didn't really change the meaning of what we were trying to do, and everyone was still on board with the language, and NAMI still supported the changes after they came from Judiciary. In fact, the special ed lawyers that I had working on it up there kind of liked their changes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Cordes.
Members, just to clarify, we had included the special ed language we're talking about here, and it was also separately sent in Senate File 1800 to the Judiciary Committee, and the changes they did make were all technical and basically wordsmithing. There wasn't any substantive changes that were made, and then those changes were amended into the language we have today on the floor.
Okay, well, members, we're coming to a close, so I would call on Senator Weger, but first I would like to recognize that Representatives Swales and McFarland and Peterson are in the audience. Did I miss any other legislators that are here? We very much appreciate your interest being here. They're, of course, very vital parts of the education committees, and with so few spots, we don't all get to be on it, but we hope to be here as often as you can, and perhaps we'll be listening carefully as Senator Stump makes announcements for next week on what you're interested in. You've been leaders in a lot of areas that we'll be considering in this conference committee. So, Senator Stump, if you'd like to give us a hint of Monday.
Okay, Madam Chair, I think what I would ask some of the conferees to maybe just stay around after. What I'm suggesting that we do is, and this is in consultation with Representative Grilling, and trying to put together some bigger areas. So, like on Monday, we would have the special education package that was talked about here, but whether we take it up and actually adopt it on Monday or Tuesday. My thought was is that it would be in your hands so that you could look it over and talk to anybody you wanted to, and then Tuesday adopt that. But we could do it on Monday too if there's agreements and if we have the parties that want to come up and all assign their support for it. Then I would like to take up the package. I believe the Senate has it. I'm not sure how much of the language the House has on homeschool, and look, go through that. I think it's pretty much a consistent package, and I think there should be a good understanding of that. And we are carrying some savings on the Senate tracking sheet for those changes, and then also, if we could look at the early childhood proposals, and I know there's some differences, and there's also some money attached to it, differences in money, but I think we could try to narrow that down somewhat and talk about the some of the early childhood things, and then a couple of the other bigger items, I think. We could try to bring together our the testing, the whole area of what to do, and I know we went through it, but I think there's more similarities than differences there. And then shared services, Senator Bonhoff explained, I think, the Senate's position on that. We'd like to at least talk a little bit about how we might be able to promote some reform and some changes out there for school districts to create some savings. And then, of course, another area that may take a little bit longer, but I think there's, again, a lot more similarities than differences is on the charter schools. That's a very large package, a very important one, I think, for all of education. And I think we could narrow those differences that we have between the Senate and the House and then bring that forward. So that's what I would like to see us do, and in preparation for when we finally get our marching orders in terms of a target, which I think we'll get a little bit closer sometime today, but I was hoping that when I visited with some of the tax committee members last night, that there'd be some rays of hope, but I guess that'll come at a later date. So
we'll know when we know, and we'll announce it when we do. So if no one else has any other comments, then I would like to meet formally with the House people, and maybe somewhere we can talk. And otherwise, members have a nice weekend, everybody, and the meeting is adjourned.